There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 204. On May 15th, 2013, I had the opportunity to attend the Nuclear Energy Assembly. One of the sessions that was quite interesting to me was the Thinking Globally, Acting Locally, Supplying the Nuclear Energy Industry in the 21st Century. The moderator of this panel discussion was John Hamry, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The panelists include James Ferlin, President and Chief Executive Officer, the Babcock & Wilcox Company, Caroline Rita, the President and Chief Executive Officer of GE Hitachi Nuclear Energy, Michael Renchek, President and Chief Executive Officer of Areva Incorporated, and Daniel Roderick, President and Chief Executive Officer of Westinghouse Electric Company. It's unlikely that I could gather a group like this for an atomic show, but since I was there and had my iPhone running, I was able to record the session and want to share it with you. So I hope you enjoy it and hope you learn something from the perspectives of these company leaders.
So now we're going to shift our focus from domestic policy to the global business prospects for our industry. This panel discussion is titled Thinking Globally, Acting Locally, a term that most people in this room have used. It's a phrase typically associated with environmental issues and environmental groups, and it encourages people to consider the overall health of our planet and to take actions locally that help protect it. But thinking globally, acting locally also applies to global trade and nuclear technologies because it offers economic and job creation benefits here at home. So our panelists this morning, who represent nuclear technologies companies with global interests, will share their insights on this issue with us. And I have the privilege of introducing our panel moderator, John Hamry, who is the President and CEO of Center for Strategic and International Studies. So this is CSIS, not CSI. CSIS provides strategic insights and policy solutions to decision makers in government, international institutions, private sector, and civil society. Before joining CSIS, Dr. Hamry served as Deputy Secretary of Defense, prior to that as Undersecretary of Defense, assisting in the development and execution of that department's budget. In 2007, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates appointed him Chairman of the Defense Policy Board. Dr. Hamry also served for 10 years as a staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So please help me welcome Dr. Hamry.
My name is John Hamry, and I want to thank you all for inviting me. It's my role today just to try to bring out the knowledge and expertise of this panel. And so I thank them for coming. I thank you for being here. Thank you. Thanks. Good to see you. While we're getting started, let me just say a word. I think the reason that Marv and Richard and others asked me to be involved with this is I've been trying to support a project we've had going on at CSIS for the last year about the future of nuclear energy. And I've listened to the congressmen this morning, and frankly I'm encouraged, but you expect them to hear them say that when they come and talk to all of you. I fear there's a deep ambivalence in this country about the future of nuclear energy. I worry about that. You know, and I worry about it from a national security standpoint. Shale gas has fundamentally undermined the economic model for nuclear power in this country. But we cannot afford to lose America's leadership role in nuclear energy. Our national security depends on it. We are the global leaders in shaping the environment that protects all of us, that keeps countries from converting commercial nuclear power into weapons. If we're not going to be a leader on the global stage, we'll not be able to shape this environment. It's absolutely crucial that America stay in the leadership role on nuclear power for our national security. And I want people to really understand how crucial that is. We're at a very pivotal time, and we're going to talk about that. People don't realize that that it all traces back to the Atoms for Peace policy framework that Eisenhower laid out, creating this dynamic where the private sector was going to be on the front line for our national security by creating the architecture of transparency for global energy. Back then, we were a parochial energy country, but now we're a global system. And, you know, you guys are deeply involved on a global basis. Two of you are actually, you know, other countries are owned part of your companies. Okay, so we know what this is like. By the way, I'm not going to spend any time introducing them. You don't know who they are. You shouldn't be here, okay? We're going to just dive right in and just ask some questions. Jim, let me start with you first. And just to say, you're trying to make this go forward, and you've got an international agenda as well as a domestic agenda. What are you most worried about right now?
From a B&W perspective, we're looking into the future. And a couple things concern us. Probably the largest, if you think about projecting new nuclear power 10, 15, 20 years in the future, and that's essentially the bet we're making today. We're making investments today over the next 5 to 10 years with the concept that we're going to bring a product to market that the market actually wants between 2020 and 2040. So we're trying to take a guess at what's going to happen, and one of the things we worry about, you mentioned already, is disruptive technology. An example today is shale gas, where it's disruptive in the U.S. The open question is, can the same concept be disruptive in the rest of the world in the next 5, 10, 15 years? So we worry about that. I'll give you another example of disruptive technology would be, and we talked about it earlier in the conference, what about electricity storage? Seems a long way off today, but economic storage of electricity changes the game, and it has the potential to shift the market to more of a centralized generation instead of the decentralized model that we have today. So that's the question. Is the concept of having large power plants be the source of electricity into the grid works today? Does that still work in 2020, 2025, or do we have a handful of smaller, more distributed generation sources combined with electricity storage that provide the power that we need across the world? We're essentially making a bet on that today as we make investments now that we expect to pay off in the 2020s.
Caroline Ritter, you're with GE Hitachi, and of course you straddle this global landscape. What do you most worry about?
Yeah,
these
are interesting.
We need a mic?
Can you guys hear me?
Okay.
All right, I'm supposed to talk down. So in the nuclear industry, you know, I think we were a lot of, you know, the global economy, if you think about that, you think about what's happening in Europe today. In nuclear, we've got to have progress on things like 1-2-3 agreements. We talked a lot about it yesterday. We talked about Saudi. You know, Vietnam's in there for the U.S. companies. You think about renewals of 1-2-3 agreements, like in Taiwan, where we're building today. So that's a big deal. We talked this morning about India. You know, India doesn't have the nuclear regime that we need today to be able to participate in that as a U.S. company. So we've got to work through that process, and that takes a lot of collaboration. And how nuclear is getting built today is different. If you think about the model in Turkey, build and operate, and that's not what we're about. You know, we're a vendor, we supply technology, and that's the basis of our company, and it's the basis of our model. So how do you put all that together commercially? How do you work the financing? How do you work the trade policy? How do you work export? How do you work advocacy? You know, it's a big dilemma for U.S. companies to be participating on this global stage.
Mm-hmm. Mike Runcheck, tell me, there was probably a day when Areva wouldn't have been invited to this meeting. You're here.
That was yesterday.
Yeah. That was yesterday.
Today we're on the same
okay.
team.
It's good, but it's good. It represents, it's good for to have you here. That's good for this to be a part of the landscape. Why don't you tell us what you think about it?
You know, we think innovation is really the industry's biggest challenge. We have to compete. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. And similar to what Jim was saying, but it also represents our biggest opportunity. When you look at our ability to grow the industry, it's through innovation and technology advancement, not only for the existing fleet and the future fleet, but it also then sets the stage for us to show our responsibility towards safety and towards the environment. After all, our industry is the only one that accounts for all of its waste. That will enable us to continue to attract people to the industry, the bright minds that will keep it growing and moving forward. And from the look of NAYGN, we're well on our way along that path. We need to continue that. But also not just attracting people into the industry because of the good jobs that we create, but also attract support for the industry. I think as we look globally, it's not just about the technology. It's also about getting the social aspects in play where people will support nuclear power and they will be comfortable with nuclear power both here and abroad. That'll help us with 1-2-3 agreements, that'll help us with 8-10 agreements, and that'll help us to be able to export.
Danny Roderick, let's give us your view here.
You know, I think that I agree with everything here. I think that as we look into this new future, I always look backwards just a little bit to see how we got here, but you can follow the cycle we're in if you've been in this business for 30 years. I've seen the gas run up, and then I've seen it run down, and then I've seen it run up. And globally, I'll tell you, the energy security issue is still a real thing. And the ability to be able to generate your own electricity without having to rely on importing LNG or importing oil is still very much in the global marketplace. You know, 10 years ago, we weren't building anything. Now we're building 8 units. In December of this year, we're pouring first concrete on 6 more units in China. So we'll have 14 under construction. So that's not an absolute bad trend, despite all the bad news that we kind of have put on us. I think there is a market reality. 10 years ago, if you were on this stage as a regulated utility, you were almost viewed as kind of like not in the groove, because in the non-regulated markets, they were doing very well. And so this market has real ups and downs that we all have to recognize. And I think the importance for companies like Westinghouse, who are global exporters, 65% of our business is outside the United States, but 65% of our people are inside the United States in our manufacturing and engineering centers. And I think that's going to actually probably continue to change over time. You know, the Vogtle project alone created 35,000 jobs. And so the SCANA project, the same thing. And this is where I think that having a little patience to watch this gas volatility is, you know, every time that there's not a big demand for gas, then the price goes down. But if everyone builds out gas, the price will go up, and it's done it every time in history.
Let's, Carolyn, you brought up 1-2-3 agreements. I hope everybody here knows what that is. I mean, this is this kind of central regulatory structure that we've used on the proliferation front. Recently, we've had this so-called gold standard 1-2-3. That's a wonderful idea if the only place in the world you can get nuclear technology is the United States. But if we hold up a gold standard that's so hard, it just forces people to go to other countries to get it. Have we really helped our security? Tell me, how are you wrestling with this? I would like to hear you.
I mean, I think it's tough, right? So I think if we hold to that standard, it's going to be a tough discussion. And I think we're not going to get the opportunity to export our technology, which is on the stage alone. I would say we have some of the safest technology in the world. And so we're not going to be in those countries. We're not going to be able to have the dialogue past the introduction of that technology. So I think we're going to have to be flexible. What I heard yesterday was at least some encouraging news, so I'm an optimist here, that both parties in Saudi, we'll use that as an example, are still at the table. So they're still having those dialogues and still having those discussions. Once you stop talking, you know, I think that it's over. But I do think we're going to have to be flexible about how we decide we're going to adhere to this gold standard. Is there any room for a discussion to be able to implement this reactor technology and work on, you know, closing the fuel cycle in what manner is in these countries? And not every country is alike, and we should recognize that.
You know, and I think that's exactly right. And I think there's one other element that we as the technology providers have to work on, which is kind of the root cause of this whole discussion, which is, can we find a way to reprocess where plutonium is not separated? And as an industry, you know, if we could solve that problem, is how do you actually recycle, how do you actually do that without creating standalone plutonium, then we have actually something we can sell into the world market to allow this to go. So I think it's the two parts. It's trying to create that level playing field, because most of these countries will, in fact, get nuclear technology from somebody.
Yeah.
And we'll have no control over it. So I think we also need to focus on the other part, which is how do we secure the reprocessing so that plutonium is not a standalone product.
Mike? And that's one of our innovations with our new techniques in recycling. Those innovations combined up plutonium in the process and enable recycling. So we're advocates for that from a 1-2-3 agreement, but also from a platform. For example, we were building with Northrop Grumman a large major component facility here in the U.S., the first in probably 30 years. And without a good export platform, the economics of that facility just don't work when you look at the U.S. marketplace today. So from that aspect, we had to slow down and suspend construction of that till we see a global market shape up and a domestic market shape up. So it does impact us. Jim, do you have anything you want to jump in?
No, I think you hit on the essence of the agreement. If the U.S. wants to have the ability to influence policy in the world, we need to have a presence from a technology point of view. And the reality is, Danny said it, you said it at the beginning, is countries have a choice today about where they're going to get their nuclear technology from. It's different than it was 30 years ago, and we probably need to build that thinking
into our
forward view, yeah, if we want to remain relevant in this discussion.
I completely agree with that. I just, about 2 weeks ago, sent a letter to President Obama. There were eight of us that signed this letter, saying we just have to take a pragmatic stand on 1-2-3 if we're going to preserve America's capacity to sell into this global market. And I'll send a copy of it to you, Mark, and if you would make it available to your colleagues. I hope you'd all look at it, circulate it. We've got to get this out there so that people understand this. Let me come back. This is something that you said, Bobby, which was this, maybe it was you, Jim, that if there are new techniques of storage, we can open up the central premise. Because, you know, the hard part about this nuclear portfolio is nuclear is fabulous as a base generator, 24-hour day. You know, but now with the kind of regulatory market we have in this country, we're turning plants into peakers. You know, it doesn't make sense. But if we can solve the storage issue, and really the Japanese figured this out, if they can promote cars, electric cars, that becomes a national storage system. And then you can build out your nuclear infrastructure, because then you do want highly efficient 24-hour base load. What are the possibilities here?
I think that could be good or bad. Pick your example. Electric cars combined with a smart grid, so you can regulate the whole system. So the electric car can act as a storage unit over time, in addition to providing what you want out of a car to begin with. So it makes some sense. The question is, for the nuclear industry, is that good or bad? That's an open question in my mind. I understand the concept you just laid out that said, wow, this makes sense. You can go with something like centralized large nuclear generators. You can store it at night. And baseload plants work. You're less reliant on peakers. You could spin that the other direction and say, it's going to change the whole makeup of the electrical system, and we no longer need large centralized generation, right? And it can be decentralized. It better allows for renewables in the system. If that's the way we go, by the way, I'm all of a sudden going to tell you that small SMRs are decentralized generation.
Yeah.
We're going to get to SMRs.
So are large EPRs.
Exactly. So we have to change our marketing material a little bit. So I would put that in the category of disruptive technology, and we don't know the answer today, but a lot of us that are making the investments today that we hope pay off 15 years from now are taking that bet.
So let's talk about Oakland.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're doing something in the industry that is unique right now as an industry. We're sponsoring an Indy race car called the Clean Air Nuclear Energy Car. It happens to have a Chevrolet engine, and a driver, Simona Di Silvestro, is teamed with Volt. And one of the aspects and platforms that GM is taking now is to use the electric car with clean nuclear energy to be able to charge it and supply it. So that platform is out there now. We're starting to see a gravitation of some of the larger transportation companies looking at nuclear power as a clean form of energy to be able to charge those cars. Because if they don't do it, most of it will come from fossil fuels, or coal, gas in particular, which have emissions issues.
Let me shift and ask about financing issues and problems that you're confronting. This is an industry that kind of is a little bit under a cloud, and so the finance markets aren't as sensitive and supportive. Government isn't as forward-leaning as it ought to be. Can I just get some sentiment? Caroline, why don't you start here?
Yeah, so I mean, I think as an example, you know, Ex-Im Banking is a requirement for a U.S. company. I mean, we are not going to be able to compete in markets where you aren't able to offer that type of financing, especially when you're dealing with global competitors. They're government-sponsored, they're government-backed. You know, they're going to have the financing to do that. And so when you're at the table, whether you're in, you know, Lithuania to Poland to Finland, I mean, the topic comes up. So you're going to have to be prepared to be able to have, you know, someone like Ex-Im Bank. And I think it makes us competitive. I do think it's a great program, and it makes us competitive, but it is the ticket to entry.
As an example, or Ariba, we have Ex-Im Bank financing for a solar plant in India. It enabled us to be able to build that project because the locality needed the financing to be able to structure that. Why shouldn't nuclear be able to participate in a similar type of financing to be able to move that technology out of the country? It would help exports. All that technology is coming from California for the solar plant. We should be able to do the same things for technologies from the U.S. for nuclear.
Is it focus and leadership, or are there tools that we need to add?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I want to, you know, we use Ex-Im Bank a lot, and Fred Hochberg and his organization have just done a fabulous job, and most people don't realize this, but Ex-Im Bank actually makes money for the U.S. government, and at their conference this year, I was actually astounded at how much money they actually make and give to the government. So this is one of the few programs that doesn't actually cost the taxpayers anything. But yet it really creates an opportunity for all of us on this stage to be able to get our products overseas. You know, recently we're in a very heated competition in the Czech Republic with the Russians. And Mr. Putin put out that he would do 100% financing for the project, which doesn't really support OECD requirements. But he said if that wasn't enough, he'd do 100% equity. Now I'm competing in that marketplace, and so we went back to Chairman Hochberg and said, hey, how can you help us out? And I will tell you that when these foreign governments get very public about what they're willing to do, then Ex-Im Bank is able to respond to that. And I think these are really that level playing field that we need to watch and rely on them to do. And I think Chairman Hochberg has actually done a very good job in that respect. But again, the equity piece becomes a different problem. But the financing piece, we absolutely have to have that from the U.S. government.
I would just say it's going to be a challenge going forward. Ex-Im Bank is a great help. If you think about the playing field for a second, sometimes you have private companies or publicly traded companies that are competing in some way, shape, or form against government-backed entities.
Right.
That's a difficult position to be in. Ex-Im Bank is a great help. I'd like to say on the small modular front, because it's a smaller financial bet, we aren't going to have that problem. The reality is, even at $1 and $2 billion, we're going to have the same issue, and we're going to be relying on Ex-Im Bank and any other innovative ideas that people have to try to play catch-up in the worldwide marketplace. It's just the reality of where we are.
Let's shift over to SMRs. It's come up with each of you, but right now, what do you think the prospect is for SMRs? We've got kind of a technology push focus from public policy standpoint, but it's got a hell of a lot of economic headwinds against it. You know, so tell me, how do you look at it? Jim, we'll start first with you.
It's interesting. The business model for SMRs has shifted. obviously, I think there's a business case, or we wouldn't be putting our money into it, right? So it'll be interesting to get some of the other perspectives on it, because not everybody's come to that conclusion. But we think there's a market there, but it's different than it was 3 years ago when we started to put money into this venture. The original concept was we were going to build an SMR. It was going to be providing electricity in the U.S. marketplace, and the international marketplace was an upside someday. That's how the business case was put together. It doesn't look that way today. Right? Today, it's, I think we'll bring a few units into the U.S., and I think the U.S. will be able to go first, and we'll be able to leverage our manufacturing and expertise and our technology. But the business case is built around the international marketplace today. So it's a fundamental shift just in 3 years on that front. We still think there's a business case there, but there's some risk involved as well.
Caroline, Maria?
You know, I think from GE's perspective, we've always taken a, you know, we're watching the markets, we're listening to our customers, listening to what they need. You know, we went a different way from a small modular reactor. You know, we are invested in technology into a Generation 4, you know, PRISM reactor, which helps with the spent fuel challenge, you know, plutonium disposition, and generates electricity at the same time. So for us, you know, we took a different bet in that dialogue. But, you know, we are interested to see how this goes forward. Obviously, a lot of talk in the industry. And, you know, the question that we've always had in our mind is, you know, a small reactor or a large reactor, you know, do you have to have a lot of the same infrastructure around both? And so can it be a cost-effective solution? Certainly not for large, you know, baseload power. But, you know, I think it's going to have its place. And so the question is when and where.
We certainly are in the small modular reactor game. I don't think there's any question about that. What we're still having is kind of this dilemma of the market shift of you know, we went out and developed a smaller 600 megawatt reactor, which then by the time the market and it got qualified, then the market wanted big reactors, so then we made a big reactor, and then by the time you get that one done, now the market wants small reactors. But the problem we all face is the regulatory approval process to get these things through actually make you miss the market that you're actually trying to get in. And I think for small modular reactors, what we're going to have is to continue to work with the NRC and with the stakeholders to find the most optimal way to get them licensed and certified. But I absolutely agree. I think the marketplace where I really see for small modulars is overseas. And I think in the U.S., unfortunately, with gas prices where they are, if you're looking at retiring a small coal plant and you can build a gas plant right there, the economics of any public service commission will drive you in the short run to a decision that I believe in the long run will be a mistake. But I think it'll drive you to that short-run decision. But, you know, the technology is going to continue to evolve. And so I think we're trying to pace ourselves with that market right now and to see the global opportunities that are out there. And I think it's got a tremendous interest, which is unfortunate because politicians talk about it. We all talk about it. But when you say, would every customer willing to spend $100 million please stand up on the stage, we'll be up here by ourselves. And that's kind of the dilemma that we have in the small modular reactor market right now.
From an Areva perspective, we look at SMRs as another part of our product portfolio because it all starts with a customer, and it really depends on what the customer's needs are. And that'll depend on the grid and customer base that they're serving. On Monday, I don't see Chris Singh here, but I think we're about four sentences away from partnering with Holtec on an SMR in the U.S. market, but then it also combines with the NGNP alliance with our high-temperature gas reactor on a smaller side, taking the path of Gen 4. We have mid-sized reactors like the Atmia and our Carina boiling water reactor that are not as quite as large as the EPR, which is a full economic scale reactor. But in essence, it starts with the customer. It starts with the customer's needs in the marketplace that they're trying to do business in. And hopefully through innovations like these, we can fit ourselves and our companies up to be able to supply that marketplace.
You've all spoken predictably and intelligently about SMRs. Can I just say something from a national security standpoint? Again, America has to stay in the nuclear business. And I think being in a leading role on SMRs is a crucial part of that. Now, we have to deal with a lack of market demand, given the price of cheap gas right now. But I think there's a national security imperative, and my personal view is that we should mandate that the Defense Department, on behalf of the government, buy SMRs to ensure secure, reliable, baseload, off-grid electricity for national security installations. Because there is a cyber problem. Let's be honest, there's a cyber problem that's coming, and we cannot afford to have national security installations without electricity. So I think we ought to mandate that we buy SMR. It'll also help us, frankly, get over the design risk and the production risk of the first flights. I mean, it's going to be tough to get these units into production. We should make it a national security priority. Okay, my sermon's over. Well, I feel better. I'm better.
We're interested in that, if you can make that happen. Are you running for office?
I'm willing to help you guys get this done, and I think it is an important thing.
I really do.
Let me ask, this again, this is about our international portfolio. What are the supply chain issues you now confront? I can remember when we were starting to get nuclear up and running 4 or 5 years ago, and we were looking for large steel forgings, and that was a pinch point, you know, in the market. Where are the pinch points now for you guys? Carolyn, start with you.
Yeah, when you think about, you know, our company, we've been building reactors for the last 60 years. So, you know, in partnership with Hitachi in Japan, you know, we've got three that are in various stages of construction in Japan today, ABWRs. We're also building two in Taiwan. So from a supply chain standpoint, the supply chain's there, but it is a global supply chain. So we don't have ultra-large forgings, for example, in the U.S. And I don't know that you need them to be necessarily competitive. What I think about is you need to have the technology skills that this reactor design is, you know, U.S., right? It's a U.S. design. So what's important? Is it the knowledge base? You know, INC systems are big. You know, the wave of digital has changed. You talked about, you know, cybersecurity. What do you want to be the experts in the U.S. when you're exporting this technology? So I don't think you have to own all of that. And when you think about what the jobs are going to be created in the U.S. when we export this technology, you know, it's engineering jobs. You know, it's across the board. And I think from a supply chain standpoint, you know, GE is a large company. We have large supply chains around the globe. And one of the things that we think about is sole source. So what we don't want to be in a position is to say we only have one provider in the world that we can get this particular product from. And so I think that's a pinch point that we think about, to say how do we bring along multiple suppliers, both for competency, muscle memory, as well as, you know, competition as you go down the road. Mm-hmm.
Danny, how about you?
Well, you know, I think there's really two things that have evolved with the new Part 52 that are a little different probably than under the original way we built. You know, what we find is that we have people we have trusted with QA programs, and we audit their QA programs, and then they subcontract to others who have had experience with their QA programs. But then you keep going down that supply chain to the very lowest level, and we're actually finding more problems there where you know, I think the sub-supplier oversight issue is challenging to really make sure that we're getting, you know, these 30, 60 year history of traceability, all these different issues. The big difference is the old use as is that we built all the other plants under, that those days are gone. I mean, it is either to the certification or it's not to the certification, and that specification is not compromisable. And so the reality of that piece of the new construction supply chain is quite different than what it was 15 years ago even. I think it's a big challenge.
Yeah, I fully agree with what Carolyn and Danny said, but I'll add a different tack from it. We're in the process of moving manufacturing back into the U.S. We recently bought Columbiana Hi-Tech outside of Greensboro, North Carolina. What we're finding is a shortage of welders. So as we've been looking at STEM education, technical education, we're starting to come across some statistics around, you say, have 4 million students in the ninth grade, and by the time they get out of college, you're down to 167,000 with a STEM degree. Mm-hmm. So that population, when you look at the demographics of not only our industry but other industries relying on a technical basis, it seems that that population available to continue to support local homegrown manufacturing is shrinking. So we're doing a lot of outreach in that area to begin working with community college, as well as the industry has done that for years, to be able to produce those folks that, as you bring manufacturing back, you're able to staff the facilities. I mean, right now, if you read the estimates, 2018, there'll be like a million STEM jobs open and unable to be filled in the U.S. So I think it's a real challenge for the domestic U.S. Industry to get back on its feet, is get the students interested in these types of careers again.
Come ahead.
Yeah, we had this discussion, supply chain inside the company, and the initial answer that came back was, Jim, you don't need to worry about that. B&W has been building nuclear reactors of similar size for the last 40 years for the Navy. We produce one or so a year, and it goes into a submarine or an aircraft carrier. You don't need to worry about the supply chain. We're good. We're a manufacturer. You step back and look at it, and that's far from true. Right? We're looking to move into a little bit different marketplace, and the reality is, as suppliers, and Danny said it, the rules are different today than they were in the past. We need to be extremely aggressive, and we need to show some leadership, and we need to work with our supply base, and we need to do it early, or we're going to get in trouble.
This is an issue I'm interested in. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, just one other comment, and I think the other interesting thing is, you know, we've added 5,000 new employees in the last 5 years, and they didn't come out of the nuclear industry, most of them, and I think all of us can never overestimate how much we have to communicate with them from our industry's history before we just throw them to work. So while it was great we pulled people out of the auto industry and out of all these other manufacturing places where jobs were down, but the value of bringing this new group in and teaching them our history is something that I think all of us as leaders have got to work on.
That's probably one of the best kept secrets of our industry is the jobs. We've hired 350 people a year for the last 4 years as well.
But I'm interested in this question because I don't think we have a very good understanding of the nuclear ecosystem. You know, we've got a commercial nuclear ecosystem. We've got a good military nuclear ecosystem. They're highly dependent on each other, but we don't know it. And we have to start mapping this out. Again, I'm a national security guy. I'm terribly afraid of what happens if this industry starts a slow collapse. I mean, just how are we going to keep an affordable nuclear propulsion industry to support our Navy reactors? But we don't really understand this ecosystem. We need to start looking at this. Because I know the commercial guys, you hate talking about the nuclear stuff, you know, because you say it's hard enough to do it now. You know, why in the hell do I want to bring in all that nuclear, the military stuff? But honestly, we are going to depend on each other. And we need to understand that going forward. Okay, I feel better again. I got that out of my system. Do we have time for questions from the floor? We don't have too much. We do have. Can I just open up? I can't see here. Let's see if there's some questions that people are opening up. Right over here, please.
One of the questions I've had is there any movement to change the Atomic Energy Act of 1954 restriction on foreign ownership of nuclear power plants in the United States?
Okay, do you guys have? I have a lot of comments on that, but I think these are the panels. I mean,
Danny's as well.
Come on, let's hear it. Carolyn, do you want to start?
You can start, John. Actually, I think this is great.
Well. Look, I mean, this is we have a completely obsolete concept of foreign ownership and control. Truth and disclosure, I've been on an advisory committee to Constellation Energy when they were trying to get nuclear power up and running again. You know, it's called Unistar New Electric. And we bumped into this foci thing, and we had this kind of this... Here's the central problem. Most government employees have never worked in the private sector. So they really don't understand the dynamic in the private sector. And political appointees know that if they make a risky choice, the other party's going to cream them politically.
And so we've got this reactive posture where nobody's thinking and everybody's trying to politically protect themselves. So I say, well, what's the foci risk with EDF wanting to invest in this country to own 51% of a plant? What's the foreign ownership and domination risk? But the moment that they get 51%, they're going to blow up their plant? I mean, it's just nonsense. I mean, it's crazy. We haven't thought about any of this. So we have to update our thinking. Are there real security issues? Sure, but, you know, hell, we got Chinese hackers breaking into your computers, and we're worried about who's on the board of directors. They all have to be Americans. Is that a security system that makes any sense? I mean, this is just... We just have to fundamentally rethink foci. Okay, I feel better again.
I would second that. When you look at when in the time frame that those laws were written, we heard Susan Eisenhower talk a lot about the Atoms for Peace and changing from weapons into nonproliferation issues into nuclear power. It seems to be outdated in time now. When you look globally, we're here advocating being able to export the technology around the world to states that will use it responsibly. And when you look coming back the other way with companies like EDF or Toshiba that want to invest in the U.S. and building plants, we seem to block that. So it seems to be a mixed message globally, and it could really substantiate a U.S. leadership position to be able to take this forward.
I think there's really two different ownership questions in there. There are vendors who want to come build a plant and then sell it, just the same way we do gas turbines. Gas turbines, a developer comes in, develops the project, licenses the project, and then sell it to an owner. So there's one question with that is certainly that doesn't pose, I would think, any nuclear security issue, because you're going to try to sell it to a group of operators, preferably U.S. operators, after you've de-risked the project. The second element is the ownership question. And I think the ownership question really comes down to does the owner come in as a predetermined technology provider? And that's the more debatable issue, is if a foreign-owned company comes in and says, yes, I'll build a plan here, but it only can be my plan and I'm not going to put it up for bids. There's two different things than the foreign company coming in and saying, I'm going to build the plant and then I'm going to put it up for sale. I think are two different scenarios that we have to kind of work through with that. And either way, the investments are good in the United States. I don't have a problem with either one of them. But I do think there's two differences of how the risk is done. If a foreign government funds the project, then it gets anti-competitive. If a foreign company funds the project, then it's an investment just like building a factory or anything else that we build around here. And I think those are where the debate is actually going to end up. I agree with you. I don't think it's a national security issue.
I think we need some new tools here. And I try to find things that are analogs that work in America. and one of them is National Safety Transportation Board. You know, we have an accident. We bring in, you know, the NTSB. And the reason that they're important and powerful is they have subpoena authority, but they don't have regulatory authority. So they can compel people to say what happened, but it doesn't become a regulatory action against them. I think we need something like that on these foci issues. We need to bring in professional expertise that isn't a regulatory expertise that then government can reference instead of it being a political exercise. Because right now it's a political exercise, and just the term is adverse. Foreign ownership and domination. That doesn't sound good, you know? So we've got to try to think of a new structure that brings technical competence to help us decide, is this a good thing or not? Okay, other questions, colleagues?
John, over here.
Yeah, Richard.
I just, a comment and a question for the panelists. Comment, John, to you, to thank you for your leadership on the nuclear issues. I hope this audience understands that having an organization with the credibility and standing of CSIS broadly supporting our policy objectives is just invaluable. John mentioned the letter that he wrote to the president just recently urging a more pragmatic approach to nuclear exports, reform of the export control process. You all ought to be aware that that letter was co-signed by Jim Schlesinger, former Secretary of Energy and Defense, by Brent Scowcroft and Jim Jones, former National Security Advisors, by Susan Eisenhower, by Mike Mullen, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. This is the cream of the national security establishment, and it's thanks to the leadership of folks like John Hamry that put things like that together. You cannot put a price on that kind of support, so I'd like to thank you for that. I do have a question for all of the panelists, and it goes to the issue of the reliability of our own government. And I know this is a bit of a leading question, so keep me out of trouble here. We did a lot of work a couple of years ago on the loan guarantee program, and in particular supporting two projects, one in Texas and one in Maryland. That had fairly significant foreign ownership, and because of that foreign ownership, they were able to get financing support from export credit agencies in other countries. So that both the Japanese and the French export credit agencies were prepared to lend, you know, on in the range of $6 or $7 billion to these projects. We were not able to get our own government lined up to provide the same level of support. And I thought at the time how very ironic and somewhat pathetic it was that the French and Japanese governments were more reliable partners in the nuclear renaissance than the U.S. government. Let me just ask each of you, to what extent is the reliability and the integrity of government policy support an issue for you? And if it is an issue, how do we address it? What do we do about it?
I can talk about this from the aspects of Unistar and the work that Unistar was doing to build reactors. When you look at the financing mechanism available to a customer who wants to place technology and build a plant, it's absolutely important because of the construction time and the licensing time. When you put that degree of uncertainty into a project, the project sooner or later begins to break down. And I think that's what we saw with Unistar and its ability to move forward with Calvert Cliffs in the earlier timeframes. Absent the loan guarantee, absent an interest rate that was affordable, as suggested by the Energy Policy Act when it was first initiated, the project became very, very difficult for Constellation and EDF to be able to move forward. So I think that reliability and dependency, if we say we're going to do it, we need to follow through with it and do it. And we had interest of other investors and other investors around the world willing to pursue that.
Okay. There are some things that we just have to work with the government on. We have to have a license from the NRC in order to be able to build a new technology. We recognize that, we accept that risk, and we work very proactively with the agency and with everybody else in government to try to keep that on time and on schedule so long as we live up to our end of the bargain. So I would put those in one category, and I would just say we need to be proactive, we need to recognize those, and we need to work hard to make them work. There's another category where the government may be able to step up and help us. That would be a loan guarantee program or something similar going forward. I would tend to view that as, I wouldn't rely on that program necessarily to make my particular investment work. Right? I'd want to have multiple options on that front. If the government support is there, hey, great, it helps the project. But we need to have, we as companies and outside investors need to have other options to make our project work, and we need to actively pursue those. So I put it in both categories. I find it frustrating as well, but it's the reality, and we need to work with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think cooperation with the government is a must. I mean, it's absolutely a critical factor. We need them, and quite frankly, you know, they need us. So, you know, we are the engine that's going to be out there developing this technology, creating those jobs, and we need to work together. you know, you talked about loan guarantees, so I can't, you know, speak for utilities, but even speaking for our own company, we looked at loan guarantees for our global laser enrichment facility and said, does that make sense? Or do we use our own company's balance sheet because of, you know, the dynamics or the cost of getting that loan guarantee? And, you know, we obviously, you know, made a choice to, you know, stay within our company when we looked at that process and how, you know, it might have been, you know, difficult for folks to follow. But one of the reasons why we thought about it was just to get that sponsorship and endorsement also with the government and that cooperation. But we clearly need the U.S. government, whether it's advocacy, whether it's, we talked about it before, government-to-government discussions in countries like India, whether it's 1-2-3 agreements. We've got to cooperate, and I think as much transparency that we can do and have efficiency in that process, the better, you know, we're both going to be. But, you know, I'm an absolute, you know, advocate for the government, and I want them to be an advocate for our business as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with that completely. I think that, you know, the one thing, though, we haven't explored, loan guarantees, we got what we asked for. Now, whether we asked for exactly the right thing or not, that's still out there. But, you know, Export-Import Bank actually has two missions. One mission is only one small paragraph, then the rest of it is about how to export goods out of the United States. One of the provisions, though, is set up to protect U.S. industry from people dumping goods into the United States. And in the event that that provision could be utilized, it actually could provide lower cost financing to utilities than what they're even seeing today from loan guarantees, because the risk premiums are a little different, and there's a lot of other scenarios that come into this. So I think the government has to stay involved in this financing. I still am encouraging Ex-Im Bank to take that one paragraph that talked about when an industry is under great pressure, is how can they help stimulate utilities to move forward with the project now in this country. One of the challenges to that, I think, is that people, you know, even the project we're building in Georgia and South Carolina, you know, both those utilities will tell you one of their biggest savings to date is the fact that interest rates are lower than what they assumed they would be 10 years ago. This lowers the cost of a nuclear power plant by hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not a small amount of money. So building one today in these interest rates versus waiting until the market comes back is and interest rates double or whatever is huge dollars, maybe as much as $1 billion of cost. Now, you can't convince your board of that, and I realize that. But if there was more of an incentive for the U.S. government to give low-cost financing and hold it, I think that'd be good. State Department support for us has been, and I think for everyone, we're seeing a lot of ambassadors really engage for us right now, I'd say as much as ever. And I think those policies have been actually helping us more recently.
You know, and I'd add one thing. You know, we put in, you know, to help with policy and trade policy, this nuclear energy director position to coordinate with the White House. Joyce Connery fills that position today, and she is a great advocate. And that position is a great advocate. And I know a lot of people take, you know, credit for that position, so thank you very much. But it is absolute something that we need. We need that interpretation. We need that cooperation to be able to get on the same side.
First of all, I appreciate the very thoughtful and wise responses to that question. I do think we have a problem, and I think it comes from a Congress that is not, it can't provide a real sustained focus on an energy strategy for America. I mean, ethanol makes no sense at all, you know. But here it's ag policy. It's not energy policy. You know, we're subsidizing the hell out of windmills that work 10% of the day. I mean, this isn't thoughtful energy policy. You know, and thoughtful energy policy would put nuclear right in the middle of it. And yet, when I talk to members of Congress, especially staff, it's, well, I don't know about that. You know, it's that kind of stuff. You know, nobody's sitting back dispassionately and saying, what do we need for the next 30 years for this country? And there's no plausible formula for a secure energy future that doesn't have nuclear in it.
And I think this is where we just have to keep on messaging over and over again, because it's not just the fact that the nuclear power plants in the United States, as I was corrected yesterday, the 102 now that we have, are going to run out of their license life over the next 25 to 30 years. You know, we've got, as an industry, got to extend those beyond that and find ways. But the other piece is that people don't realize is 40% of the U.S. coal fleet is going to be nearing the century mark in that same period of time. And if you look at an energy cliff of 20% of nuclear and 40% of coal dropping off the face of our economy, that's a much bigger impact than anything the financial cliff ever had on this country. And so if we don't start now with the new builds across this country, what you're going to see, or with aggressive programs like we're with Westinghouse, trying to figure out, how do I make a nuclear power plant run for 100 years? How do you do that? But if we don't do that, everybody's going to go to gas. And when everybody goes to gas or renewables and gas, then you're right back to the same scenario. Gas prices are going to go up because there isn't enough gas in the world to replace that big of a market segment in gas.
And if you support CO2, that footprint of renewables and gas does nothing to solve that problem. It makes it better, and in the end, we're still putting out carbon.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. Just let me just let this as a wrap up for each of you. Just a kind of concluding observation about where we are, where you think our opportunities are. Mike, I'll start with you.
I go back to innovation. I think it's imperative upon the industry. We've done it before. We've done it historically. We need to keep innovating. We need to keep making our plants safer, more reliable, and more affordable economically to operate, and also for our customers. That'll keep us growing as an industry, both here in the U.S. and then globally. It'll be able to set up an export platform. We'll be able to demonstrate our responsibility for nuclear safety and the environment in a way that primarily other industries can't do that. We have all of our waste accounted for. And while we're doing that, it'll be able to start attracting and keep attracting that talent that we need to keep the engines of innovation running and running our facilities and our plants.
I would just say it's a dynamic international marketplace. We talk about energy policy. There are a lot of moving parts. We can take that as a negative and withdraw, or we can take it as an opportunity, as an industry. We can get out, we can communicate the message and all the positive we can do, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S., and we can show some leadership and try to influence that and be in the right place 5, 10, 15, 100 years from now. To be able to provide some real value to society. And I would tend to, I think that if you listen to the leadership that's in this room, that's where we're headed, and we need to stay focused on that.
Sure.
So, you know, GE's a big company. So we've been around for 120 years plus. And, you know, we think about 100,000 of our 300,000 employees are in the energy markets. And nuclear is going to have its place. You know, it's going to be, there's not going to be one solution. There's going to be multiple solutions. And as a technology company, we want to bring that technology to the market globally. What we're most excited about, though, is our opportunity with Dominion, you know, right here in the U.S., and executing on that technology partnership we have with them.
You get the benediction.
You know, there's 200, there's over 200,000 people that make a living in the nuclear industry in this country, and I think our challenge is really to get all of them mobilized. I mean, we're getting outmaneuvered by gas right now in political space. We've certainly been outmaneuvered with renewables. And I think we just got to continue to push as an industry to show our job. Because it's funny to me, it doesn't matter where in the world you go to, the discussion is jobs. It's not carbon anymore, it's jobs. And I think we have to be more visible about the job creations that we have and how we're growing. And continue to grow the technology. But at the end of the day, you know, we do have to make some reforms, I think, in our government to help us export. And I think that commitment, is along with energizing the entire population of the nuclear industry in this country, can put us back on the map, is important.
First of all, I think you all have done a fabulous job, and I would say thank you. I think to this point of mobilizing the industry, NEI is a great leader.
Well,
in this town.
I want to say something. This is Neil Diaz, and I'm normally very quiet, but I just heard some comments.
Could we get the microphone up? I can't hear you, sir.
It's on. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Neos Diaz. Like I said, I'm normally very quiet, but I just couldn't resist saying something that I think is very important. Okay? All independent agencies of the United States government should be independent of politics. And if they are not, they cannot do their job. Whether it's by influence of the Congress, or the industry, or whatever it is, that is a no-no. And in the NRC, that is not tolerable. We dealt in 1997 with the issue of foreign ownership, very straightforward. We think it's a resolvable issue. However, the industry, Congress need to demand that these agencies, not only the NRC, are completely independent of politics. I spent 10 years in the NRC, six and a half years as commissioner, 3.5 years as a chairman. I never saw the issue of politics being raised. I dealt with both parties, we dealt with the commission. That is a must. And the industry has a serious role to demand that the agency is not politicized.
I served with Niels, and I, Jeff Merrifield, I agree wholeheartedly with his comments. Same circumstance. I was going to ask make a comment earlier. You know, we talked about foreign control and domination, and we did go over these issues. And if people remember, it's a two-part test. One, and we focus a lot on the percentage of foreign ownership, but the other issue is it's an inimicality test. Is the ownership inimical to the interests of the United States? If you get rid of the percentage, and you ask just the question of inimicality, you can allow countries like France or others to invest in this country as they should. And Congress should go ahead and make that change and allow the Commission to work that well. This is the best country in the world in which to invest. And why can't we have a circumstance where we've got 3,500 to 4,000 people at a site like we do at Vogtle building power plants, whether they're owned by a United States company or not? And Congress needs to understand that message, that there is an opportunity, a real jobs opportunity in nuclear power that is being forsaken because of what is a very old test that we both agreed on should have been eliminated years ago.
I think the value of the Unistar petition is that it's caused the NRC to say, let's take another look at FOCD. And I think that's a good thing. NEI, I think, is going to be taking a lead role in that. It needs to be rethought. It's good for the country for us to get more people to invest here. We ought to be investing more of our own money, and frankly, in nuclear power. That's another story. So would you all, with your applause, say thank you to these remarkable panelists? It's a good question.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.